going to tape this program. The mic is only going to pick me up, so it won't pick you up. We'll make this into an MP3, and if anybody would like a copy of the MP3, just give me your business cards and I'll be glad to give it to you. This is an Ideas to Action seminar. What that means is I will offer to meet with you for 1 hour by phone or in person if you want to take any of these ideas and turn them into some actionable results. There's my mission tonight. Why is it important for Rotary members to have a board perspective? We'll work on creating a board strategy. If you have some paper and a pen, that would be good because there's an exercise to do. If not, this may be the first time I may ask you to take out your mobile devices or your laptops and turn them on. That may be a first in a lecture. We'll help you start putting together a board resume. Then we'll talk about distribution of your board resume. Finally, if we have any time, we'll talk about how to manage your risks, and we'll talk about compensation. Here it is. First board, I'm going to give you a really fast history lesson. You are going to wow them in a game of business trivial pursuit. The first board of directors ever was created in Holland in 1620. It was a company called the America's Company, and later on it was changed to the Dutch West Indies Company. How many of you know about that from history? There were two strategic business units. One was in Brazil, which was in the slave trade. That was absolutely very successful. It lasted for 150 years. The other was a failure, and that was tobacco farming in North America. And the territory that they were looking at started at the Delaware River Valley to the south and the Hudson River Valley to the north. The headquarters of the North American operation in the Hudson River Valley was in the island at the mouth of the Hudson River called Manhattan. The whole experiment failed because they didn't understand tobacco likes warm climate. But you still see the vestiges of that today. How many of you have ever driven around rural Connecticut and seen tobacco farms? Connecticut is like the number one place in the United States for the, if you're a cigar smoker, you know, the, what do you call it? The wrappers. Because it's rough, and that's the vestige of the Dutch West Indies Company. So this was a company that was invested by, it was one of the first international investments. There were investors from Sweden, from Norway, and from Holland. And so they needed a representative to manage their interests, and they were called, it was the Lords. And then they got a commoner on the board, so they had to change the name to directors. And the reason why it's called a board, this is how you're going to maximize trivial pursuit. Whenever a ship came in from the Dutch West Indies, you know, you got about 2 days' notice before it actually docks. You know, there'd be a lookout, or ships coming in, they would have flags. And so the directors would assemble at the dock to welcome the men coming off the ship. And there was a little ceremony. The first person would come would be the captain. He would report to the directors. He would hand a log which shows what he had spent, and they would review it. If they were satisfied, they would then give him some money. And then all of the other members of the crew would come off afterwards, and they would shake hands with the directors, and they would get the money. And then eventually somebody said, "You guys need to be seated. This is a long ceremony." And then somebody got a wooden board, you know, like when you were college students? You put the board here, and then you put a you know, what do you call it? Like a... something to anchor the two. But basically, the whole issue about reporting to the board comes from that ceremony. And the board was that makeshift table. Now, in 1620... those directors really had four core responsibilities. core responsibility number one was to review and approve the strategy. They didn't make the strategy. Management made the strategy, but they had to review it. They had to approve it. Second core responsibility, hire the CEO and fire the CEO and pay the CEO. First CEO was Peter Minuet, and the second CEO was Peter Stuyvesant. The third is review the finances to see that the money are being spent on behalf of the owners and not misspent. And finally, nose in, fingers out. You're in Holland. These operations are in Brazil and in New York. You can't supervise them. You're always behind the times. You're always operating in history. So keep your fingers out of the operations. To this day, Sarbanes-Oxley notwithstanding, this is the core mission of a board. And sometimes board members forget the last thing. Keep your fingers out of the operations. Board members, because if you start getting involved in the operations, then you also pick up the liability. So you stay out of the operations. Nothing has changed in 250 years. Boards, all life is equally valued, but of course some lives are more valued than others. And there is a pecking order for boards. So let's look at the food chain for boards. And what I'm going to ask you to do is I'm going to go through the food chain. I'm going to ask you to think, where are you in the food chain? And then what would be one level above where you were currently at? In other words, I really would like to be on the Disney board. I really would. I think I could add a lot of value because I've seen all the movies. and I've been to Disney World, so but they're not going to ask me. That's not where I am. So where are you and where do you want to be? What's the next? So the first are the small nonprofits. That's the trade associations. And there are so many in the city of Boston. I'm sure there are many in Munich. In your churches, there are the nonprofits, the human service organizations. You have to start somewhere. And this is a good place to start. Because Disney, no offense, Disney doesn't need you. Apple doesn't need you. The Apple's not going to call you. So you got to start somewhere. Why don't you start with a small nonprofit service organization? Here's the deal. It's easy to get on those boards. It's awful hard to get off them. Right? How many have had that experience? Okay. So here are a couple of things I would recommend. One is, look around the room, find out who else is on the board. If your first instinct is that you're the smartest person in the room, you don't want to be on that board. At the very least, there should be somebody on that board that you say, I could learn from that person. So there's something in it for you. I know the people in Rotary are selfless and committed, but come on. You got it. There's got to be something for you. So you don't want to be the smartest person in the room. Second, before they offer you and they start talking about it, start talking about term limits and saying, what are the term limits? And if they say, what are you talking about? Term limits mean, what are the terms of office? If they don't know what you're talking about, again, these are small professional service organizations, they may not know. You explain to them, 2 years, 3 years. And then you say, term limits. I will serve two terms of 2 years each, and that's it, and then I'm through. And you say that at the front end, because if you say it at the front end, then 4 years later, when 3 years later, when you announce that you're leaving, they're going, oh, how can you do this to us? We depend on you. Oh, no. 3 years ago when you offered me this, I said I would do it. And and then it's not a personal matter. But if you don't do this, what will happen is somebody is going to say, really what she's doing is she's saying something about my stewardship. Or really, you know, she doesn't like me. So say it at the front end. You can always forget you said it if you love being on the board. More likely than not, the issue is you have to think strategically about your career and you move on from there. So these are great places to start, but this is not where you want to finish your career. Any questions about that? The next would be large nonprofits. What I mean by large nonprofits, Brigham and Women's Hospital, the Partners, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Boston Symphony, many of the HMOs in Massachusetts. These are very visible. It's a fabulous networking opportunity, but you got to bring your checkbook with you, because they're going to look for donations. They will sometimes let you slide with you know, pay in kind in terms of work, and particularly the human service organizations. They're just so happy to have you. They may say they'd like you to donate, but you know they're not going to kick you out. The next is one of my favorites, which I would call private family-dominated companies that I would call heritage companies. I got a call this morning from a company. It's a third-generation family business, and they're going to fire somebody who has been with the company 15 years. And the president is so distraught because it's the right thing for the business, but he just feels crappy, and he wants to make sure that the termination is done consistent with the values of the business, which is we treat our long-term employees like family. And my attitude is, I'm so grateful to be working for you, because you know so many of the businesses that I work with really don't care, and it's so nice to have a heritage business where there's values. And they try to live those values. And often those businesses, they're kind of funky. They're kind of not necessarily high tech. They're not necessarily state of the art, but they're just lovely businesses. And often in these businesses, your great value in a family-dominated business is that you are not part of the family. And the most important thing that you can do if you get on one of these family businesses is to raise the issues, you know, the elephant in the room that everybody knows is the elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about, which is succession planning in the event that the CEO dies. The elephant in the room. Is your daughter really competent to take over the business? You know, example, I was on a board of one of these companies. It's a well-known retail company here in the Boston area, and the father was absolutely determined that his daughter would take over as CEO upon his death, and she was the COO. And what she couldn't tell her father was that she was married, she wanted to have a kid, she doesn't know how to be a mother and put in 70 hours a week that this business requires, and it's more important for her to be a mother, and she couldn't bring herself to tell her father that, and she needed a non-family person to do that for her, and that is such a gift that you're bringing as the non-family member. The other thing I would advise you, if you're in one of these family businesses, and you may think I'm not being serious, but I'm being very serious. Write your letter of resignation when they offer you the position. And then give it to the CEO and leave it undated. And tell the CEO, here's my letter of resignation, it's undated. All you have to do to get me off this board is to put a date on there and give it to me and I'm gone. I'm not here to make your life more difficult. I also want you to know I have a copy of that letter in my office. And the moment that I feel that I'm not taken seriously, I'm going to take my copy and give it to you. I'm out of here. If you do not, what happens in these businesses is for the first couple of years, you are the real salvation. You are the person who is the outsider. You really can observe, you can really make an impact. But when you start getting co-opted by the family business, you become the family, you know, in other words, you're also the family lawyer or you're the family banker, and all of a sudden, you know, you're afraid to talk about the family issues that are dysfunctional. Now you're part of the problem. So you have to be prepared to leave, and you're not going to be taken seriously unless the CEO knows he can't co-opt you. So again, I'm not being facetious. Write a letter of resignation and leave it undated. Anybody been in a family business?
Yes.
Do you agree with what I said?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Wish I knew it then.
Okay.
6 years I spent. Fabulous business.
Mm-hmm.
But after a while, you become part of the issue, no doubt.
Yep. Anybody else? Next is private equity dominated companies. What can I say? Now the world has completely changed, because when you were with a heritage company, the CEO dominated the board. And the reason you had that letter was to say, you can't dominate me. Once private equity comes in, the political situation totally changes. And many CEOs who are used to life under a founder-dominated situation don't survive under a private equity situation. It's different, and they don't get the help that they need. When you're looking at private equity people, and again, this is your world, so please, I'd love you to speak up. You have people who are very savvy business people, who either know the industry or they think they know the industry. They usually are very financially savvy. And they have an agenda, and usually they have an exit strategy, and the exit strategy is going to be dominating that company. You will get on a board of a company like that if you have earned the trust of a private equity company and they think that you have some value add. But who's controlling this up? It's often the private equity. The private equity world often does violate nose in, fingers out. They're going to stick their nose in very heavily, because they feel they know this business, and they know where the business is going to go, and it's going to be driven by the exit strategy. And if the CEO is not on board with that, the CEO is going to be gone.
And the thing that, you know, a lot of people don't realize, is that, you know, the private equity firm, it really isn't their money. They have a lot of large investors, usually institutional investors, and they have a fiduciary responsibility to invest that money into privately held companies, generate the returns and get the money back to the investors. And that's what's going to drive the private equity firm's decisions with respect to that portfolio company. And if you're going to be in sync with the private equity firm with respect to a portfolio company, you have to realize that that's their basically marching orders and march in step with them.
But it is a completely different animal from anything we've talked about before. Again, a board is not a board. Part of my point is a board is not a board. Just as a 3-year-old boy is not the same as a 12-year-old boy is not the same as a 65-year-old boy. You know, it's different.
But Larry, just as a and really, the private equity firm is also interested, very obviously, selfishly interested in the success of that company, but they are looking for the exit. They want the company to be successful, and they want to be able to exit that company. Hopefully it will continue to be successful after they exit the company, because that makes it easier to sell the company. But, so their interests are typically aligned with the company as far as future successes, but they are interested in getting an exit.
Typically you get on those, right, and you get on that board because you have a relationship with the private equity, and you have... you have a relationship of trust. And again, there is kind of an issue about who. I have a fiduciary responsibility to the company, but my long-term relationship is to the private equity company that brought me in because I'd like to have more board, more opportunities.
And Larry, you're usually an investor too, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have some skin in the game there.
The pre-IPO is now you're moving to a newer, and by the way, for some of you, there may be new opportunities because there's a new law called the JOBS Act, the Jobs Act. And it is looking to correct some of the problems of Sarbanes-Oxley, which had too many financial requirements such that many small companies decide, you know, it's easier just to it's easier to be acquired by a larger company than to go public. The problem is that when a company gets acquired, usually what happens is job loss. On the other hand, if a company goes public, it's usually going to use the money to grow in through internal purposes, organic growth, they call it. So the JOBS Act, the Jobs Act, is designed to streamline some of the reporting relationships, the onerous reporting relationships of Sarbanes-Oxley, cut it down, make it more viable for small growing businesses to actually go public. So this may create some opportunities for people in this room that did not exist this time last year. Again, pre-IPO, now you're dealing with Sarbanes-Oxley, and you just need to understand what that law is all about. That's not the purpose of this program, but it is. Then we go to small cap public company. And one of the issues when you're dealing with a public company is what's the balance between the role of the board as a counselor versus an auditor. Counselor versus auditor. In the Heritage Private Company, it's really much more counselor. In a startup, it's much more advice and counsel to the CEO, not audit and oversight. But as you get public and as you get larger and larger, the CEO doesn't really need the board for advice and counsel. They've got staff for that. The board tends to be more audit and oversight. So one of the things you have to decide is what kind of balance do you like? You know, so for example, I happen to like smaller companies. I like privately held companies because I can do more of what I really like to do, which is be the CEO, advisor and counselor and door opener and help make things happen. But as you get bigger and bigger and bigger, the role changes. Anybody been on different in a public company? Tell me about your experience.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right about a small cap public company. They have all the issues of a large company to a smaller scale. You wind up knowing what direction the company is going in. You have to make sure that you're in compliance with all the rules and you don't get off track.
Yeah. And also, given the litigation environment, we'll talk about risk management later. You may find that your lawyer is if you go to a lawyer and say you're interested in being on the board of a public company, the reaction of your lawyer is going to be, "Are you crazy?" So some people are advised not to do this. And then finally, you get the mid-cap and the large cap. I'm not going to be dealing with that in this talk. But what I'd like you to do is give some thought now to where are you today. And if you're not on the food chain at all, that's okay. You got to start somewhere. So start with getting involved with associations, maybe this one. Your professional association, can you get on a board? So where are you now? And then if you're on the food chain, what's the next step? Because again, if you are already on a small nonprofit, part of your plan is, when am I going to leave? Because the reality is, you only have a certain amount of time that you can donate to board work. So give that some thought. Now the next is, your advertising is a resume that starts off with what is your value proposition to be on a board. And I can't tell you how many executives I've worked with over the years, they say, I want to be on a board. Well, show me your resume. And their resume has absolutely no link to what is their value proposition to be on a board. It usually has strategic results-oriented CFO. Well, that's great if you're looking for a CFO job. But what about a board? So what you need for a board resume is a board summary. So if you have a mobile device, you might want to take them out.
We actually got paper brought in.
And go to boardoptions.com. And I'm going to do this here so you can watch it.
We do need some paper. There's a pad so we can pass you.
You got the wireless password?
Yep. Yeah, that would be great. So this is what boardoptions.com looks like. And what I want you to do when you get on boardoptions.com, I want you to go to the Board of Directors Talent Bank. And when you get to the Board of Directors Talent Bank, let me just show you a couple of things. This is an application that you can fill out. It's free. And it asks certain questions about your experience that can be useful to help you begin to articulate your value proposition to be on a board. So if you want to follow up for tonight's program, just go to boardoptions.com, go to the Board of Directors Talent Bank, and go here. Then scroll down, and then we have about 800 people around the world who are on this Board of Directors Talent Bank. You'll see there's a certain format to them, a certain logic to them, and I want you to try to write something that's consistent with that logic. And this would be in the executive summary of your resume. So here is a CFO, CPA, public company director. Her experience includes banking, construction, publishing, utilities, low-tech manufacturing, retail, and professional services. Notice how she is very specific about the industries that she can make a contribution to. So the idea is every industry where you know something, you want to put that down. She says, her next sentence, so the first sentence is, here are the industries I know well, familiar with the following industry. The next sentence says, can contribute to full board discussions involving blank, 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 blank. Now, let me explain what that means. Full board discussion. What do boards discuss in full? Now, we go back to 1620 and the Dutch West Indies companies and how nothing has changed. Review and approve corporate strategy. Can you do that? Second, are you qualified to look at hiring and firing a CEO or hiring and firing senior executives? She also adds other things that are important for boards to discuss. She can look at CEO performance, mergers and acquisitions, risk management. Some of you are probably familiar with risk management and finding sources of capital. Many of you in this room have contacts, you've got Rolodexes, you can help a company find sources of capital. Now there's a next series of sentences that says can serve as chair of an audit committee. So she could be on the audit committee. typically private companies will have three core committees: audit, which is the committee that's responsible for monitoring the finances to make sure things are being done in compliance with the law and shareholders' money is not being misspent. Audit, compensation traditionally refers to the remuneration of the CEO and sometimes the CEO's direct reports. Now here's a little twist. Anybody in HR here? No HR people? Okay. At some companies, particularly public companies, the compensation committee is now being called compensation and management development. Typically, the CEO's job description will say the CEO is responsible for succession planning. And that's sort of like motherhood. Everybody is for that. The problem is, it's one of those things you can, it's like dealing with the deficit. You can kick the can down the road. And there's lots of political reasons and personal reasons why a CEO wouldn't want to name his or her successor. And they're not just all ego. It could be, you know, once I say you're my chosen successor, you're going to leave. So I might as well keep playing the two of you against each other as long as I can. So the boards have sort of said, enough of this. We'll take the responsibility. So the new name is compensation and succession planning, compensation management development, which creates potential opportunities for HR people. And then finally, there's something called nominating and governance committee. The nominating and governance committee is responsible for the selection of people who are going to be on the board. They are also responsible for board of directors self-evaluation. Board of directors self-evaluation is required for New York Stock Exchange companies, and many of the larger nonprofits do board of directors self-evaluation. And by the way, if any of you are looking at companies, one question I would ask is, tell me about your board self-evaluation. If they smile and say, we do something, that's one. I'm not sure I'd want to be on that board. If they say we have a very rigorous process and we take it very seriously, that suggests that the board has a culture of saying, we expect and demand continuous self-improvement of all our employees, starting with ourselves. So I look at board self-evaluation as a cultural indication of how seriously does the board take continuous self-improvement. In Germany, what's the committee structure of a typical German company?
It's very similar.
Very similar? One of the differences in Germany is that workers get a seat on the board.
Yes. 50%.
Mm-hmm.
That's very different.
Yeah.
But the committees still have the same. They are the same.
Yeah.
You have nomination, you have audit.
Well, you know, again, is it working? Has it worked for Germany to have workers on?
Yeah, in certain situations, yes.
Yeah.
But that depends on the personal situation.
Yeah. Yep.
There are highly respected and very efficient union representatives. There are, mm-hmm. But they are in the minority.
Yep.
What is the hazard to a potential board member of the board not taking self-improvement seriously? Is it that it's an organization that doesn't get as important to improve themselves, and hence it's a stagnant organization?
Well, the whole issue of board self-evaluation came about in the wake of a scandal with the New York Stock Exchange, where the New York Stock Exchange was a nonprofit, and the board members included the CEOs of Merrill Lynch, Goldman Sachs, Citi, and somehow they got it that they paid the CEO of this nonprofit a humongous amount of money, and that got got publicized, and the issue became, how could a bunch of smart people do something so stupid? And the result of that was the New York Stock Exchange then required all of the member companies to engage in board self-evaluation. So you don't do the stupid thing that we did. The reality is they haven't enforced it very well. So many companies just go through the motions and say, okay, this is where legal, you are the board, I'm the chairman of the board, this is the time we're going to do board self-evaluation. Anybody got any problems with how we're running it? No, let the record show that we had a board self-evaluation. Let's go play golf. It's tea time. Unfortunately, that's how it is. What I am finding is the following. The lack of effective board self-evaluation is a real turn-on to people 55 and older because they don't like it. But for people... I would say 50 and below, particularly the younger people, it's a turnoff. There's a general, you know, their attitude is, the attitude of the older folks is, look, I'm spending all of this time on a board. Don't saddle me with this additional stuff to do. It's just a waste of time. But the attitude of younger people is, I have a limited amount of time to spend and I'm not going to waste it. If you guys aren't serious about continuous self-improvement, I don't want to waste my time with you guys. So then I find a generational gap.
So the role of the board?
Well, most of the board meetings, the focus is the CEO. What has the CEO done? The only time in the year when the board shines the spotlight on itself and says, what are we doing to improve shareholder values, is board self-evaluation. You know, so that's why board self-evaluation is, it's a useful diagnostic tool to find out if the boards are serious and what their reaction, what their attitude is for it. I thought New York Stock Exchange companies would grab onto this. They didn't. Interesting enough, though, the large nonprofits grab onto it because it protects the reputation of the board members. When the inevitable role of spotlight, you know, was the board asleep at the switch when XYZ happened? The answer is no. We actually did a board self-evaluation. So let me, what I'd like you to do is, let me make this, let me show you, here's an example of one. So it's the same model, senior financial executives, industry experience includes, blah, blah, can contribute to full board discussions about strategy, new product evaluation, operations outside the United States, mergers and acquisitions. Next sentence, qualified to serve on an audit committee, compensation, nominating governance. And what this person says, well suited for private company wanting to grow. So he knows where he fits in on the food chain. So I'd like you to take out a piece of paper and use this as a model. How would you craft something for yourself? I'll give you 3 more minutes. All right. I just wanted to get you started. Why don't you stand up and stretch? Come on, stand up and stretch. Stand up and stretch. If you want more inspiration, go to boardoptions.com. Go to the Board of Directors Talent Bank. There are other models. If you want some help, just send me an email. Again, if you go to Board of Directors Talent Bank at Board Options, there's a form to fill out that will help you better articulate what your proposition is. Okay, sit down. You look like you're having too much fun. We don't have much time, so I'm going to... again, how do you articulate your value proposition? We've done that. Think about for yourself, where are you on the advice and counsel versus audit and oversight? For me, I like to be on the advice and counsel side, not the audit and oversight side. Where do you want to be? We talked about the board resume. It's basically your resume, but with a new executive summary. Now we look at distribution of that wonderful new resume. What are the distribution channels? We may not have time to finish this, but I want to get you started. The best distribution channels for you will be partners in law firms. Corporate partners, not litigators. How many of you have been on boards of directors where an attorney served as secretary to the board?
Yeah.
Okay. There is a mythology that there's something called attorney-client privilege, if we ask our attorney to serve as secretary, then that privilege extends. It turns out to be not true, but most lawyers won't tell you that. It doesn't make any difference. But many partners are secretaries to boards, so they take the minutes. Because they are secretaries, if there's a resignation or retirement coming up, they will know about it. Good partners, like all of you, are good professionals. You always want to be seen by your client as more than just a lawyer. You are a business partner. So if a lawyer says, you know, I understand that Jane is getting off the board. My partner at my firm knows somebody named Martin. He sent me this board resume. Looks like he might be a good fit. Now, why don't you review it? You decide. And if it's the right person, then you have to use the search firm. And I've just saved you $40,000. Just another service that I do for you. So the boards are a great distribution challenge. Now here's the trick. Here's the trick. You are most likely to get help if an attorney doesn't know you. Isn't that sounds counterintuitive. The attorneys that do know you are best suited to refer you resume to their colleagues that don't know you. Here's the reason why this is the case. The difference between a referral and a reference. Are we all clear what that is? Can it be a little confusing sometimes? So if I know you and I refer you to this person, then it turns out you are a kleptomaniac and you do all sorts of terrible things and, you know, you're disruptive. He's going to come back to me as the partner. Didn't you know those things about her? So now you've put me in a win-lose situation because I know you. But how well do I know you? You know, how well does an attorney know their client? On the other hand, if you ask me to refer your resume to a partner of mine in the office who doesn't know you, then that partner can say, you know, this resume looks interesting. I don't know her, I've never met her, but on paper she looks interesting. You might want to take a look at it. If that she's the right person, you just saved $40,000, $50,000 off a search fee. Now that it's clearly a referral, not a reference, right? Because I said I don't know her. So if it turns out you're a great board member, I get the credit. But if it turns out you're terrible, I'm not going to get blamed. So does that make sense? So the people that don't know you will be more helpful than the people that do know you. And again, lawyers, particularly corporate attorneys, are good sources. And again, many law firms now are multinational, with offices in Munich and Beijing, and in different states. And even if it's a small or medium-sized firm, they have reciprocal relationships with other firms. So use attorneys. Obviously, other board members. If it's a nonprofit, you may want to just investigate GuideStar. We don't have time for that, but GuideStar is the repository for Form 990s, which are legally required for nonprofits. GuideStar.com is free, but it's a good place to find out who's on boards. Also, if you go to, here's a little trick, investing space business week space name of an individual. If you know that somebody is on a board of directors of a public company, name somebody that you know who's on a board of a public company. John Smith. You just Google investing space business week space John Smith. And you will find you click on see other board relationships, you will get a graph of his board relationships of public company boards, and you will know who he knows. It's a very powerful tool. Tax partners, forget about it. They're not going to help you. Forget about it. They're so concerned with their liability after the downfall of what was the name of that firm? Because you may be on the audit committee, and if they recommended you for the audit committee, I mean, it's too big a deal for them. I've never found a tax partner helpful. Recruiters actually will not be that helpful for you. Recruiters are like me, I'm a waiter. Customer says, I want a peanut butter and jelly sandwich on rye. Can you get that for me? What am I going to say? I'm the world's best getter of peanut butter jelly sandwich on rye. Woe is me if I go back to that customer and say, yeah, I know you want a peanut butter jelly sandwich on rye, but I think a tuna on toast is really what you need. Am I going to say that? Probably not. So recruiters have very narrow specs. And if you meet that spec, that's fine. They want to talk with you as quickly as possible. But if you don't, they're not going to be that much help for you. National Association of Corporate Directors, NACD. It's called the National Association of Corporate Directors. Very strong operation here in the Boston area. You may want to go to their meetings. Again, learn how to be a director. The NACD is the place. Board Options, which is our website. We have a lot of educational material on how to be a board member. The Commonwealth Club is a fabulous place for women executives in Boston. They have a board of directors talent bank. Just look up the Commonwealth Club. I'm sorry, the Boston Club. It's the Boston Club. My mistake.
You have a few members there tonight.
Huh?
You have a few members here tonight.
So Boston Club is fabulous place. Good education, great board of directors, talent bank. Sorry, my mistake. Bumper sticker. What do you say to the outside world? What I recommend that you say is, I'm very busy, and I only have time to serve on one board, and I want to make it a good one. The more eager you come across to be on a board, the less eager people are to have you on a board. It's kind of like this law of supply and demand. If you're too available, people don't want you. If you say, I don't have a lot of time, suddenly you're attractive. So that's the script. I only have time to serve on one board. I want to make it a good one. Sorry to tell you this, but you got to give it time. This is very much a hit and miss kind of operation, and you got to have the proper perspective. And I find, in terms of networking, you know, unless you have a sort of a name brand out there, it's going to take a while. So don't get discouraged if you've been doing this for 6 months. Why don't we, again, managing risks. If you're approached about being on a board, you want to ask if there's director and officer liability insurance. And even for nonprofits, you want director and officer liability insurance. There are two risks that you are taking. One is the risk of your ruining your reputation in the business community. And the second is some sort of lawsuit ruining your wealth. Example, there was an organization, nonprofit, I forgot the name of the organization, and they were not doing well financially. They were approached by a for-profit company about buying them. The board said no. The company then went bankrupt. The bank then sued the board members individually for violation of their fiduciary responsibility. Turns out that when you're in the vicinity of bankruptcy, your fiduciary responsibility shifts from the community as a nonprofit to the creditors. And they didn't do that. And so the bank caught them and proceeded to sue them. So even if you're in a nonprofit, a nice do-good organization, who would sue us? Any lawyer would sue you. Wouldn't think twice of it. Anybody doubt that? So you want D&O insurance. You want, again, you want to make sure that you're covered for actions taken while you're a board member, even after you leave service of the board. Have your own attorney review the D&O, and don't rely on the CFO saying to you, "Oh, don't worry, we have D&O insurance. It's covered. Don't worry about it. Worry about it." I'll just close with one story. I was asked to serve on a board. It was a startup technology company. I'd like to think they thought I was handsome and clever, but no, it was probably because I had good contacts. Why was I interested in the board? Well, I thought the technology was kind of interesting, and it was in a space I wasn't really that familiar with, so I was curious about it, and I thought I could add some value because there were some applications to talent management, and they didn't know that, but I knew it. And then finally, there was somebody in the room that I was very interested in. He was the former president of Southwest Airlines. And I'd read a book of his, and I thought, this is a guy I could learn from. Again, I won't join a board if I think I'm the smartest guy in the room. And I thought, he's smarter than I am. So I was interested. Now, what was my compensation? Not only did I not get compensation, I had to pay for the privilege of doing that. I had to pay $7,000. They called it skin in the game. In return, I got pieces of worthless paper called equity. I never expected this would work out, but I paid for the privilege, didn't get any compensation at all. Then I started opening doors for this company because I've got a pretty good Rolodex. So I found a guy named Mark Madaus in New Jersey who was president of Roche Diagnostic. I convinced him to be a beta site for the company, and it totally failed. Not because of him, not because of Roche, but because of my company. My company subsequently went bankrupt. Then what happened, so I lost, so you'd say to yourself, if you look at this from a traditional accounting point of view, this was a disaster. I spent $7,000, let's put a dollar value in my time, let's put another $25,000 of my time on that, and what I get out of it, I got zero. Well, not exactly, because Mark Madaus came to Boston, became president of Millipore, hired me to do three board searches, And then I had another public company that was looking for somebody who understood the airline industry. Did I know somebody in the airline industry? I said, of course I do. Lots of contacts. And through that, through the Southwestern Airlines president, I got the CFO of Continental Airlines on that board. So when I look at the transaction was a disaster. If I look at from a broader perspective, what was the monetary value of the relationships that I had made? Fabulous. So sometimes looking at things from an accounting point of view can be misleading. And that's certainly true with boards. So thank you very much.
That was an excellent talk.
Hope everybody enjoyed it. Know that people have places to go and things to do. It's a big time for us, so